I'd like to discuss in this class two issues. And one issue is something which many people ask and are bothered by, is the fact that Judaism seems to be so focused on minor details, nitpicking, hair-splitting details. Judaism has 613 commandments. That's a lot of commandments. Now, the truth is, no one person is obligated in all 613 commandments, unless you are male, female, Kohen, Levi, Israel, single, married, divorced, all simultaneously. I'm sure there are communities in California like this, but for the majority of us, we're not obligated in all 613. Nevertheless, many people do find it overwhelming, the amount of commandments there are. I should have a bunch of spares, if you don't mind just passing it back. Don't get up, just pass it. Pass the whole set, yeah. So, a lot of people are bothered by that. And it is difficult to understand how they serve to make me a better person. So, what I want to do is, first of all, talk about what the purpose of the mitzvot is, what's the purpose of these commandments, and then we'll look into the methodology. What method do they use to achieve their set goal, their set purpose? So, number one, in the Medrash Rabbah, in Genesis, which says the following, mitzvot were given in order to refine humanity. As it says, all the words of God are refined. The Hebrew word refine, tsurufa, has two meanings. It means to remove impurities, as in refining silver, refining petroleum, etc. It also means, l'tzaref means to join together. What is the meaning of those two ideas? The commandments, as we discussed yesterday, when we spoke about Rabbi Akiva and Turnus Rufus, we talked about that? Was it here, maybe, or next hotel, or was it in London? I don't remember. Where Rabbi Akiva is confronted by a Roman by the name of Turnus Rufus, and he asks him which is better, the deeds of God or the deeds of man? We discussed that, right? I think. And he says, Okay. So he says, which is better, the deeds of God or the deeds of man? And what Turnus Rufus meant to do was to attack Judaism for circumcision, for the idea of how dare you interfere with the human being if that's the act of God, deeds of God, what are you doing changing? So Rabbi Akiva went and brought out a stalk of wheat and a three-layer chocolate mousse cake. And he says to Turnus Rufus, which is better? Deeds of God, ways around the wheat, chocolate mousse cake. Obviously, Turnus Rufus is forced to admit the chocolate mousse cake, deeds of man, is superior to the deeds of God, stalk of wheat. The answer is what Rabbi Akiva was saying was the following. Just as the wheat is designed to be perfected, to be changed, to be refined, to be turned into the chocolate mousse cake, the bagel, etc., so also the human being in the world is designed to be changed, refined, perfected. And that's really the purpose of humanity. What is refinement? One example would be the awareness of others. The awareness of others' existence. You know, sometimes people act in such a way that you feel like just saying, excuse me, I exist. They like, don't take your existence into account. Little babies. My three-year-old wakes up, middle of the night, Abba! I go into the room, I say, what do you want? And he says, I'm thirsty. So you drank last week. Right, but nevertheless, I bring him a cup of water. Now, at the age of three, I do not expect him to wake up and think, Abba's tired, Mummy's tired, why should I disturb them? I am capable of getting it up myself and getting it. He doesn't think that way. On the other hand, if my 13-year-old would wake up in the middle of the night, Abba, what do you want? A drink of water. I would immediately recommend he gets a social worker and a lawyer, right? This is not going to be pleasant. At his age, I expect him to be refined enough to be aware of the presence and the existence of others and their needs. That's refinement. Refinement. So that's one aspect. The other aspect, as we said, not just refinement, but also meaning. To join us to meaning. That life is not just survival. Life requires meaning. And that's another purpose of the commandments. That's number one. Number two, Sifra in Kedoshim. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, a person should not say, I do not like meat and milk mixtures. Rather, he should say, I'd like it. God said not to eat it. What is Rosh Hashanah Gamliel trying to tell us here? What he's trying to tell us is the following. You know, the Torah prohibits us to eat meat and milk mixtures. What should our attitude be when we refrain from eating these things? So Rosh Hashanah Gamliel says a person should not say, ugh, I can't stand it. They should say, looks good, I'd like it. God said not to have it. What is the meaning? So the meaning came to me, and I was reading to my children one of the great works of English literature, Green Eggs and Ham, by Dr. Seuss. Now, the first question that my children ask when I read them, Green Eggs and Ham, first question my children ask is, what's ham? For some reason, in the mind of a child, a green egg is not a problem. They're willing to accept that. If they can accept purple dinosaurs that talk, if they can accept frogs that date pigs, they can accept a green egg. And if you've been to the school cafeteria, I'm sure you can accept green egg. But they ask me, what is ham? So I say, ham is the meat of a pig. And what do you think their first reaction is? Ugh! And I tell them, it's not ugh. I say, what do you mean it's not ugh? We don't eat it. I say, the reason we do not eat it is not because it's ugh. I said, there are 2 billion Chinese, cannot be wrong. Right? They eat it. Right? It's not ugh for them. I say, so they say, so why don't we eat it? I say, we don't eat it because we follow what Hashem said. And Hashem said it's not good for the Jewish soul. In other words, what is Rosh Hashanah Gamliel telling us? We don't want to be instinctive followers. We want to be thoughtful, conscious people. One of the purposes of the commandments is to instill in us consciousness and thought versus instinct and autopilot. You can go through life on autopilot, and you could even be a good person doing that. But that's not what we want. That's not what God wants. He wants us to think. And that's what Rosh Hashanah Gamliel is telling us. Another purpose of the commandments is to give us pause moments for thought. Number three. A person is obligated to walk in the ways of God and to imitate him. We believe that the way to be good is by imitating the ultimate perfect good in the world. The ultimate perfect good is God himself. So therefore, to imitate God is one of the purposes of the commandments. To be God-like. Imitate God. That is something which we believe is one of the most essential purposes of the commandments. Being good is being like God. In fact, I believe I saw somewhere that the etymology of the English word good is related to the word God. Because God is the ultimate good. Number four. This is a little complex, but the Tikkuni Zohar says the following. You know, there's a system in Hebrew of encoding the alphabet, which is known as Atbash. You ever heard of that? Atbash means you take the first letter Aleph and you substitute it for the last letter Taf. Second letter, Bay, substitute it for the second last letter, Shin. Now, why are we doing that? There's a philosophy behind that. You see, when an architect builds a building, what's the first thought the architect has? Nope, that's not the first thought. The first thought is the complete concept, the complete concept of the building. So, you know, there's a verse we say Friday night in Lecha Dodi, which says, Sof ma'aseh b'machshavat chila. The end of action is in the beginning of thought. Because the first thought you have is the complete building. That's the same as the last action. What's the second thought you have? Structure, materials. Third thought, perhaps, is the frame. Fourth thought, foundation. Fifth thought, type of area you need. Sixth thought, go to the city council and get a license. That is the same as the first action. In other words, the last thought is the same as the first action. But the first thought is the same as the last action. Is this clear? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that the Aleph, which is, so to speak, the first thought of creation, equals the Taf, which is the last action, the last letter of the alphabet. And they go towards each other. The first letter is representing thought, the last representing action, meaning in the middle. Now, based on that idea, one of the words we have, mitzvah, commandment. Mem is the 10th last letter of the alphabet, which is therefore what letter? Yud. Tzadi is the 5th last letter of the alphabet. What does that correspond to? Hey. Yud hey Vav-Hei is the name of God. Okay, now, you notice, I cheated. How did I cheat? Why did I cheat? I did not decode the last two letters. The name of God is Yud-Hei and Vav-Hei. So half the name of God is there in the word mitzvah without decoding, but the other half I decoded. So I cheated. The answer is, I did not cheat. The Zohar says that mitzvah really is a symbol of what life and the world is. Because you see, the world, the name of God, is hidden and yet it's revealed. It is half hidden and half revealed. If the name of God would be completely revealed, for instance, we went up about 3 weeks ago in Jerusalem, 3 weeks ago there was a meteor shower, which happens about once every 33 years. And the best place to see it in the world was Israel. And so I woke all my family up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And we went up onto the roof of our apartment building to watch the meteor shower. And we're all standing there. It was unbelievable. Thousands of meteors. Splashes of light across the sky. Long streaks. Now imagine, had we been looking up and one of the meteors does this. Yud. Hey. Love. Hey. And we say, cool. God? Now that wouldn't leave us with much free will, would it? You would not be you'd really be forced to admit that he's there. But, on the other hand, if there'd be no possibility of finding God in the world, that wouldn't be fair either. So therefore, God himself, so to speak, his name, is half inscribed and half concealed. And the way that we reveal the name of God in the world is through the mitzvot, through the commandments. When I engage in an act of altruistic kindness, I am revealing the image of God in the human being. There are some people who are engaged full-time in concealment of the divine image. Mike Tyson, for example. Okay? Mike Tyson, through his career, both in and out of the ring, I would never say this to his face, obviously, right? But he is a person who is involved in the concealment of the divine image in the human. You don't look at him and say, godliness. There are people like that. The governor of the state of Minnesota, Jesse the Body Ventura. He does not call himself Jesse the Soul Ventura. Jesse the Mind Ventura. Okay, it's Jesse the Body Ventura. There's a concealment of the divine image here. One of our purposes in life also is to reveal the divine image in the human being, to reveal the divine image in the world, to reveal godliness in everything. That's the idea of mitzvah. So we have four ideas in the commandments. Refinement of the human being, awareness, meaning, perfection. We have also, number two, consciousness versus instinct. Number three, imitation of God, who is good. And number four, revelation of God in the world. Those are the purposes of the commandments in the world, the logii. So now, by what methodology do the commandments achieve these purposes? Let's have a look at the section entitled, very originally, methodology. Number one, 1A, morality. What do you need to be moral? Sounds like a stupid question. You need to be good. But what does that mean? What does it mean? What are conditions necessary to be a good person, a moral person? So many philosophers debate and discuss this. There seems to be a consensus on two things. You need to be committed to something moral, to something good, and you're supposed to act consistently with that commitment. Is this clear? You both have to be committed to the good and act consistently with the good. Supposing you're only committed to something, but you don't really act consistently with it. Are you a moral person? Supposing you act consistently, but you're not committed. I'll give you examples to clarify it. In Singapore, on the roof of commercial vehicles, a light is attached by law. And that light is attached to the speedometer. And if the car goes over the speed limit, the light flashes, the police pick you up, give you a ticket. Is that a great idea? They were going to do that in Israel, but they decided the entire country would look like a disco. It'd be unbelievable. You would never be able to move. But the idea is now in Singapore, also, you get instant $500 fine if you litter, if you jaywalk, if you vandalize something, you're beaten. In other words, it's a country which is very safe and very clean, and the traffic flows very smoothly. Is that because the people of Singapore are committed to these ideals? No. Not, and we don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. But it could be because you just can't get away with anything else. Does that make them good? Not necessarily. So therefore, if you're just consistent without being committed, that does not make you a good person. Likewise, the reverse. What if you are committed to something as an ideal, but you're not really consistent? Are you good then? No. Clearly not. I'll give you an example. Principal phones home. Father answers the phone and says, hello. He says, hello, this is the principal of your son's school. I'm sorry to inform you that your son has been expelled for cheating in an exam. Now, what's every parent's reaction going to be? My son? Cheating? The tzaddik? The gaon? The righteous genius? Why would he need to cheat, for heaven's sakes? Even if he needed to, he wouldn't. He says, look, the principal says, look, I have evidence. What evidence? What? Says the answers in his exam were exactly the same as those of the boy sitting next to him. Now, what's the parent's reaction going to be? Ha! The boy sitting next to him, the son of Satan. He cheated from my son. So the principal says, I have further evidence. Says, what? He says, look, question number 19. The boy sitting next to your son wrote, I don't know. Question number 19, your son wrote, I don't know either. Now, so the father sits the son down and he gives him a lecture about truth, honesty and integrity. You know, parents have got these filing cabinets of lectures. A, adulthood, right, B, right, yeah, C, cars, D, drugs, dating, right, that type of stuff. So he takes out the honesty lecture, H, honesty, right? And he's giving the kid the honesty, truth, integrity, now house, and now family, blah, blah, blah. Right. You know, the kid's sitting there, right? Anyway, the phone rings in the middle of the truth and honesty lecture. And his wife answers the phone. Oh, hello, Mr. Goldberg. Right, and the father says, just a moment, son. Says, I'm not home. Well, says, I'm sorry, Mr. Goldberg, he's not home. On the cellular? He says, I'm sorry, he's in Tierra del Fuego. Yes, the cellular network does not reach there. Right, goodbye. Father says, okay, fine. Then he gets back, where were we, son? Oh, yes, truth and integrity. And he carries on with the lecture. Now, obviously, this man, on the one hand, is committed to truth. I think he really believes deep down that truth is a good thing. On the other hand, not when Goldberg's on the phone. So he's not consistent. He's not consistent. We would say, and this I agree with Peter Singer, we would say that in order to be a good person, you need both commitment to that which is good, and you also need consistency with that which is good. So now what I'd like to do is give you an example. How easy is it to be consistent? How easy is it? It may sound pretty easy. Well, don't lie. I mean, okay. But I want to bring one example, and let's see how easy it is to be consistent. My example is a vegetarian. Supposing you've decided that your principle in life will be the following. Animals should not suffer for the sake of humans. Therefore, I will not benefit from the suffering of an animal. Sounds fairly easy? That's your commitment in life. Animals shouldn't suffer for humans. I will not benefit from the suffering of an animal. Easy commitment. Let's see. Let's take one day in the life of this person and see how easy is it to be consistent with this principle. What's the first moral decision you have to make relevant to this when you wake up in the morning? Before you put on shoes, the first thing I do in the morning is not put on my leather shoes. First moral decision you have to make, what cosmetics do I? Do I brush my teeth with Colgate, which may have been tested on thousands of rabbits at the Colgate factory? Hundreds of hours of teeth brushing. Or do I use Body Shop? Natural ingredients. No animal suffered to produce this toothpaste, etc., etc. What do you do? What would be consistent here? What would you do?
Body Shop.
Body Shop? Okay. Next decision you have to make is, do you wear leather? Okay. So you have to decide, look, the animal which I'm wearing is already dead. On the other hand, right, supporting such an industry is benefiting from the suffering of an animal and is inconsistent with my moral beliefs. What would you agree with that? Does that sound correct to you? Okay. So then you say the following. Now what's the next decision you have to make? Next decision, after you've got leather on, or not leather, you're not wearing leather, what's the next moral decision you have to make relevant to this commitment? Brekkie! What are you going to have for breakfast? So you go to a restaurant, and you ask the waiter, what's good for breakfast? The waiter says, the steak and eggs is great, mate. It's an Australian breakfast we all have, right? So steak and eggs is wonderful. I say, excuse me. I do not want your animal carcass. I do not want your fried chicken embryos. I don't believe that animals should suffer for the sake of humans. And therefore, I will not benefit from their suffering. So the waiter says, oh, no, you don't understand. He pulls out a certificate. His steaks in this restaurant come from the Happy Valley Ranch. I say, what do you mean? In the Happy Valley Ranch, cows of all colors, shapes, and sizes roam freely without fences. They eat all types of herbs and grasses, both legal and illegal. They get shiatsu massage every day. They get reiki therapy, aromatherapy, fresh manure all the time, right? Cows, they lead a wonderful, happy life. And eventually one of the cows dies. And we cut it up and make steaks. So he says, this cow, my dear fellow, is kosher for vegetarians. Now, assume his information is correct. Would you eat the steak? Why not? Leave kashrus out of it. Don't get religious on me. I'm talking about vegetarianism, right? Staff member, right. No, so I'm talking about this, right? Would you eat the steak? Well, I would decide, well, hey. So I'd say, look, fill up an esky of these. Esky is an insulated container we use in Australia. Anyway, so I'd say, give me a few kilo. So I go home, right, put the skimmer on in the pool, get the Fosters in the fridge, right, mesquite wood in the barbecue. Okay, I've got the steaks marinating, and I take them on the barbecue, put them on the barbecue, invite some friends over. Beautiful day in Bondi. Right, and I'm standing there with the steaks on the barbecue. And now I'm thinking to myself, but just a second, what is the neighbor going to think? Will it not undermine my principle if the neighbor thinks he's going to smell and he's going, steak? He's going to say, Becher is a stinking hypocrite. Here he is preaching that animals should not suffer for the sake of humans. He's got steak. So let's say I go over to I convince him. I say, look, you don't understand. Look at the joy in that steak. That's from the Happy Valley Ranch. I mean, look at just oozing out of that steak. Happiness, contentment. Now, even if he believes me, should I also not worry about the person passing by? You walk by the house and you smell a barbecue. What do you want to do? Have a steak? So now, am I not encouraging the consumption of meat by having a barbecue, even though it's kosher for vegetarian steaks? Would you say it's inconsistent for me to do this, or consistent? What would you say? Inconsistent. By the way, for those who know any Hebrew, this is called Maris Ayin. Okay, so I decide I'm not going to have the steaks because it undermines my plan and my ethics to have people thinking, A, I'm a hypocrite, and B, wanting to have steaks themselves. So I do not have these steaks. So now I'm hungry. So I go to the supermarket. I say, dairy food. What could be wrong with dairy foods? So I stand there at the dairy, I'm getting yogurt and milk and cheese and stuff. Standing next to me is a guy in an animal rights liberation t-shirt. You know, one of these fanatics stands there like this. The white eyes, right? And he's standing there and he's saying, you like milk? And I say, no. I say, but I don't eat meat because I don't believe animals should suffer for humans. And he looks at me and he says, and what about cows? I said, well, what do you mean? If you don't milk a cow, what happens? It suffers terribly. I said, on the contrary, I said, my dear fellow, eating dairy products is alleviating these cows of their suffering. He says, what about cows in the wild? Cows in the wild. It's the type of thing one does not often think of. Bovine history is not my field, but I have studied it a little bit, actually. The last time cows were wild, domestic cows now, have never been wild. There are certain animals never exist in the wild. You never see a newspaper article about a group of hikers in southern France was attacked by a horde of poodles, and the wild poodles, right? It doesn't happen. Because the last wild cow was an auroch, A-U-R-O-C-H, lived in Europe thousands of years ago. They just took the largest and most stupid cows, aurochs, and bred them together till they came up with a modern domestic cow. But anyway, let's ignore that for the moment. So this animal rights person says, look, he says, the reason you've got all these milk products is because cows are in captivity and have been exploited. And the reason you have to milk the cow is very simple. Cows in the wild don't need to be milked. You know why? Why not? They have babies, and the baby nurses, the calf nurses from the mother. When the calf stops nursing, what happens? The mother stops lactating, there's no more milk, no problem. The guy in the t-shirt says to me, the reason you've got so much dairy products is because the calf is over there in the veal section of the freezer. If you think that you are not benefiting from the suffering of an animal by having dairy products, think again, buddy boy. And he throws a bucket of milk on me. Instead of blood, you know. So now, does he have a good argument or not? What would you say? Is he right or is he wrong? It's also clear cut, I think. Because on the one hand, he is correct that we are exploiting the cows. On the other hand, if he suggests releasing the cows into the wild, don't know how that would work. So, and right now in their present situation, if you don't milk the cows, they will indeed suffer horribly. So it's not such a clear-cut decision, this one, is it? But you know what? I decide to be stringent. So I walk over to the health food section. All these seaweeds, fermented tofu, nori, etc., etc. And I say, I'm starving by this time. So I get myself a power bar. A power bar must be okay, right? But then I look at the power bar, and it's got in it civet, natural flavorings. Natural flavorings, castorum and civet. What is castorum made from? Beavers. What is civet made from? Cats. When it says in a product, natural flavorings, they can have civet and castorum in them, both of which are cat and beaver extracts. They're natural. And I look at it and I say, oh my gosh. And then I see it's got gelatin in it. What's gelatin made from? Animal bones. And it's got stearic acid. What's that made from? Beef. And it's got glycerides from animal fat. And it may have red food coloring, cochineal beetle extract. Right? And I look at this and I say, oh, this bar is a veritable slaughterhouse. It's an abattoir. I can't eat this. But then I say to myself, but just a second. According to the FDA regulations, and this is actually a fact, it is only the ingredients here are less than 2% of the whole. So if the animal ingredients are less than 2%, I say to myself, what's 2% between friends? Would you say it's correct? 2% is okay? If it's animal content, 2%, is that okay?
No.
If you buy vegetable oil in the United States, according to the FDA, they can label it vegetable oil even if there's up to 2% animal fat. So, is that okay? Why not? It's only 2%. Well, then I remember Pfeiffer's Handbook of Physiology, 1956, says the average taste threshold for the average person is about 1.61%, 1.66%, which is about 1 in 60. And if it's 1 in 60, that means it can be tasted. But it still would be less than 2%. So I say to myself, is it consistent for me to ignore a concentration of animal products which is less than 2% but more than 1 in 60? What would you say? Inconsistent. So I decide, of course, by this time, I'm absolutely starving. Right, we're already 2 hours into the day. I have not had breakfast yet. I'm ready to gnaw on my arm. So now, if you're extremely hungry, what would be the natural thing to do? Nope, phone your grandmother. Booby, I'm hungry. Can I come over to eat? Of course, dear. Right, so she puts in the grandchild code on her notebook computer. Right, and it has a list of every product you've ever expressed a desire for from the time you could speak. And she programs the barcode reader, and she goes to the freezer. Right, she puts it all in the microwave. I walk in there an hour later. The table is laden with food, and all of it is meat. Now I have a value conflict. Look, think of it. If I refuse to eat, she is an Eastern European Jewish grandmother who's offered me food. If I refuse to eat it, will she suffer? You do not have to have a degree in psychology to answer this question. Of course she will suffer. But on the other hand, I don't want to benefit from the suffering of the animal. So now I have a value conflict. The grandmother, the animals. What do I do? What I'm pointing out here is the following. That if you really want to be consistent with any particular moral code, if you don't want your decisions to be arbitrary, to be made by your stomach or whatever nerve ending happens to be in play at that time, if you don't want to be like that, you want to be good, you've got to plan these things out. You've got to think about that. You've got to be consistent. You know what? We have 10 statements in the Torah. that encapsulate within them all 613 commandments. And you know what the 613 commandments are? They enable us to act in a manner consistent with those 10 commandments. Because if you really want an entire society, an entire people to be consistent with certain commandments over thousands of years, you know what you need to write? The Babylonian Talmud. Because that's what the Talmud does. It goes through every single conceivable situation, every in and out, every what if it's this value conflict, life versus the value, human suffering versus the value, finance, every area. What about, what if someone sees me? Do I only have to act correct or do I have to act in such a way that it seems to be correct? All these issues of moral consistency are discussed in the Talmud. And if you don't discuss them and you don't think about them, you're not being consistent. Even something as simple as thou shalt not murder. You know, the Bible has been translated into every language known to mankind. Even some not, like Klingon. There's in the Bible, there's a new American Bible I saw reviewed in the New York Times. They translate it into a modern American language called Ebonics. Thou shalt not murder, don't waste nobody. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, don't diss the man. Now, however, simply translating something into a language that you understand is not sufficient for you to be able to keep it. You've got to have a moral code that enables you to be consistent with those commandments. And that's not an easy thing. That requires a lot of complexity, and that really is the essence of the Talmud. That is number 1A. 1B. Judaism is a living law, meaning we believe that everything in life has some type of moral ramification. Virtually every decision has a moral ramification. And therefore, there is no area of life which is going to be devoid of some type of moral guidance, some type of injection of meaning and revelation of spirituality. If you look at the subjects discussed in Jewish law, there is no subject that is not discussed. Nothing. Nothing that is not discussed. And that is because there is no area of life that doesn't have the ability or the possibility of having a spiritual dimension. And therefore, we believe the Torah as a living law has to apply to all those situations. Rav Shiller, the Rosh Yeshiva of Rosh Sameach, where I teach, he was in Brooklyn College when he was younger. And he was the only person, he was in a sociology class, he was the only person in the class with a yarmulke at the time. I understand now you need a yarmulke to get in. But at the time, he was the only person in the class with a yarmulke. The lecturer looks out over the room the first day and he says, "You with the yarmulke, what's your name?" And he says, "Me?" He says, "Yes." He says, Schiller. He says, "Tell me something, Schiller. You a student of the Talmud?" Rav Shiller said, "Yes," wondering, where is this guy going? And the professor says, "In that case, I have nothing to teach you. The Talmudists were the greatest sociologists of all time. They created and perfected a system that gave the Jews a high quality of life, in literacy, in family life, in crime, in every area, in every single geopolitical and socioeconomic situation imaginable. I have nothing to teach you." Rav Shiller said, "That's okay, Professor. I did not come here to learn anything. I just need the credits." But there's an idea that that's indeed part of the abundance of commandments, is because life is abundant with situations. Life is full of opportunities for revelation or concealment, full of opportunities from reality. The type of car I buy, is that a moral decision? I believe it is. I believe it is. It's a moral decision. Am I not responsible if I don't need a Humvee? Like, you know, an 8-cylinder car with, you know, with 12 wheels, 12-wheel drive, off-road vehicle that can, you know, can basically cross the Grand Canyon without problems, right? And where do I live? I live in Melbourne. It has never in recordable history ever snowed in Melbourne. It never goes below freezing. All the roads are nice and wide. There is no need ever for an off-road vehicle. And yet, thousands of people have them. I think, now the fact is, based on reports I've read, off-road vehicles, SUVs, produce more exhaust emissions than regular cars. They have lower fuel efficiency than regular cars, and they are more dangerous to the occupants of other cars in an accident. Is it not a moral decision? Should I not have to take that into account? The Torah says virtually everything in life has some type of moral or spiritual basis, and you need a commandment and guidelines for everything. It's another aspect. 1C. Awareness of the spiritual side of life. For example, we often forget why we're here. We often forget what we're doing. So we have reminders, prayer. When I make a request from God for health, wealth, and dignity, I'm forced to think about what I'm going to do with it. Why do I need it? So I remember I mentioned before this girl who came to my house in Toronto once and asked, I mean, she came to the door and said, would you like a free copy of the Toronto Star? And I said, nope. She said, would you like to buy a subscription? And I said, stupid, right? If I don't want a free copy, of course I don't want a subscription. But then she said, please buy a subscription. And I said, I don't want one. She said, no, please. It's like a new sales technique. It's like, you know, beg, right? I said, well, why are you so desperate to sell me a subscription? She said, I'm in a contest. If I sell one more subscription, I get a CD player. And I really need one. I'm thinking to myself, I mean, had she said to me, I need to make money, my father is unemployed, my brother needs to go to college, my mother needs an operation, I am the only source of income in the family, could you please buy a subscription to the newspaper? Then I would have hesitated before saying no. You know, but again, if she comes to me and she says, I need a CD player, that does not impress me. Does not impress me. In other words, when we come to God and say, please, and he says, you know, God will say, why do you need the extra $10,000 income this year? Because there's a new high-definition television from Toshiba, which is a 6-foot-wide screen, has sensor around, you can smell what's happening on screen, blood spurts at you, the whole world. It's like, great, I said, only $10,000, right? So God is going to say, need? That's what you're going to do with it? Prayer helps us to focus what life is about. Blessings. We eat. I was on the plane, got on the plane from Detroit to Seattle. I did a Shabbaton in Seattle, and it was a fairly empty flight. Sitting 2 seats from me was a woman with a large crucifix carrying a Christian Bible, who I figured was probably not Jewish, and 2 seats from me. Now, anyway, I got onto the plane. My ears had not adjusted to the altitude. I really couldn't hear too well. So I got on and sat down 2 seats from her. They brought me my kosher food first, which they do in order to exacerbate anti-Semitism, right? And anyway, so I get the kosher food, and because I couldn't hear too well, I said a blessing about this level. Actually, let's say one again. That happens to also be the blessing you make on unidentifiable food. If you're on the plane. So anyway, I said it about that level. She turns to me and she says, excuse me? And I said, well, my ears pop. I said, oh, no, I wasn't talking to you. She looks around. She says, who are you talking to? I said, God. And she said, oh, okay, well, I figure she's a religious person. She can understand that. You know what Bertrand Russell used to say? If you speak to God, you're praying. If he speaks to you, you're schizophrenic. So anyway, I said, I was saying a blessing. She said, really? And I said, yeah. And she said, you always say, I said, every time I eat or drink, I say a blessing. She said, that's beautiful. What did you say? I said, blessed are you, our God, King of the universe, that everything was created through your word. And she said, that is one of the most beautiful prayers I've ever heard. And it made me think about it, because I've been saying them for years, and I don't think about it much. And it took a pastor from Detroit, right, to remind me, yes. But really, when we say blessings, we're meant to think. Why am I eating? Why am I here? Why am I living? Appreciation also. Many, many factors. Mezuzah. Take the mezuzah. You know what a mezuzah is, everyone? So mezuzah, there's a custom to touch the mezuzah as you go in and out of the door. Some people kiss it. Some people just blow it a kiss. Some people hug. Whatever. You know. But to, you know, just to touch it, to think about why. Maimonides says so that you're aware. See, think about what's written in the mezuzah. What is it? If you think about all the philosophical implications of the mezuzah, for just one moment, you walk out of the door, it's 8 o'clock, you're going to work, touch the mezuzah. Start thinking about the mezuzah contains, Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Monotheism, chosenness of the Jewish people, love of God, obligation to do the commandments, obligation to study Torah, divine providence, reward and punishment, prophecy, exodus from Egypt. You know, 5 o'clock, you're standing there, The kids come home from school, they run under, you know, my kids wouldn't even notice if I was doing that. You know, they're just like, oh, it's Abba again, you know. So you stand there, you think about it all, that's it, right? But the mezuzah is meant to remind you of these ideas, to give us some meaning in life, to give us a reminder of why we are here. So we don't just get caught in the rat race, which the rats always win, and just keep going. D. Rituals, we believe, are behavior modification techniques. If you want to modify your behavior, improve your character, the way to do it is through action, not through thought. If I'm an angry person, and I decide, you know what, as of tomorrow, I just won't get angry anymore. That's it, I've made a decision. Will that work? First person to cut you off in traffic, murderous thoughts go through your mind, right? Oh, I'm not going to be angry anymore. Right, the kid does something which you've already told them 50 times not to do. Anger! Rage! Okay? So of course it's not going to work. What's the way to do it? The way to modify yourself is through action. Action. Because see, that's the easiest way. In martial arts, in the army, you know, they teach you where do you attack the enemy? Where's the best place to attack? Churchill said it. In attacking Italy, what did he call Italy? The soft underbelly of the Axis. Right? Attack in the place where no one has got muscles. No one's got muscles in their eyes, in their sinuses, eardrums, throat. People stop there. But anyway, that's where you attack. Okay? That's where you attack. The same is true of the evil inclination. Where do I attack it? In the area that is least powerful. What is easiest to control? Action, speech, or thought? What's easiest to control? Action, speech, or thought? Action. Most of us get angry, but we don't automatically just lash out, you know, we don't do that. We can control our actions. Speech, however, you, loathe, etc. Well, we can't control our speech. And even if we can control our speech, we very often think. Okay? So therefore, the halacha says, the way to do it is, work on action. And that's what a lot of the commandments are based on, is the modification of action to achieve a modification of the self inside. I'll give you some examples. The dietary laws. Kashrut. Normally, eating is a very instinctive matter for most people. I'm walking along the street, and I say, Mordechai hungry. Now, if kashrus doesn't come into it, I look first door, Mordechai hungry, Mordechai eat. I walk in, give me food. Right? That's it. That's instinctive. However, the laws of kashrus teach me self-control. Mordechai hungry? Is the store kosher? Is it not? If it is kosher, have I eaten meat recently? Can I have the milk? What blessing do I make? Etc., etc. Self-control. You know, you ever had the experience, for those of you who are parents, I'm sure you'll relate to this, one of the most horrific experiences of parenthood is going to the supermarket with little children. There are very few things as horrifying as that. Especially, you have the scenario, you go into the express counter, 8 items or less. There's an elderly woman in front of you with 25 items. You're not allowed to say anything. Why? She's elderly. Because she'll say to you, you can't say anything to me, I'm elderly. Right? So she's standing there with 25 items. She's trying to pay the account with a third party check from Guatemala made out in Thai baht. Right, and she's got coupons from Sears in 1901, and this is the wrong coupons. Yeah, and the checkout clerk, you know, she's got her the pierced eyebrows caught in the typewriting movement. Yeah, and the boyfriend's on the phone, right, and the kids, of course, are like, because you're surrounded on both sides by candy. So the kids are like, can I have one of those? May I please have one? May I please have one of those? No! Right? And you're getting angry. It's like the whole thing. You know, and my kid will say, Abba, may I please have one of those? I say, no. He says, Abba, if you don't give me one of those, eventually I'll start crying. And then I'll throw myself on the floor and have a full-fledged tantrum. And I'll go hysterical. And you'll get angry and embarrassed and you'll probably end up hitting me. And someone will call the police and a social worker. And then you'll need to get involved with lawyers and everything else. Is it not cheaper to buy me a candy bar for 25 cents? My kids really do this. So, yeah, you give them the candy bar. Now, I'll give you a real-life scenario. We went from Israel to Toronto in 92, back in Israel in 96. But, you know, I'm at the supermarket checkout with my 5-year-old. He was 6 years old at the time. And we're waiting in line. We pretty much have a situation like I just described. Or, no exaggeration. And And he says, "Abba, I'll just have one of those." I say, "Well, just a second." So I look at it and I say, "It's not kosher." It wasn't. She says, "Oh, amazing." I said to myself, my 6-year-old who observed the dietary laws has more self-control than most adults in the Western world. Tell an adult in the Western world, no, you cannot have this pleasure. What will they say? What do you mean? I won't do it regularly. I won't get caught. I'll do it safely. I won't get addicted. I won't... Blah, blah, blah. No is not in the vocabulary. What do you mean no? It's a pleasure which I want. And you're telling me no? Kasherus teaches one of the most important ideas in life. Discipline, self-control. Sabbath, similar idea. There are certain things I will not do to get ahead. One of them, work on Shabbos. One of them is that Shabbos is a self-imposed restriction on how far I will go for money, power, glory. This far I won't go. It's a line in the sand which I will not cross. Charity. What is the main purpose of charity? Commentaries say not only for the benefit of the recipient. One of the main purposes of charity is for the benefit of the giver. The more I give, the more of a giver I become. That's the essence of it. And it's the action of giving that makes me into a giver. Clothing. Clothing. The clothing that you wear affects how you look at yourself, how others look at you. Take, for instance, the fellow I mentioned before, one of the leaders of the United States, Jesse the Body Ventura. Right? So now, he walks around, he dresses in clothes that emphasize Jesse the Body Ventura. Now, if he would not wear cut-off t-shirts, muscle shirts, stuff like that, you know, maybe he wouldn't look at himself as Jesse the Body Ventura. If I walked around in muscle t-shirts, I'd talk to myself as Rabbi Mordechai the Body Becher. That's not a... Don't laugh. I mean, the point is, the way we dress looks at ourselves as, am I Mordechai the soul and body Becher? Or am I just Mordechai the Body Becher? Okay. How we dress affects how we think of ourselves. It also affects the way I feel. Now I know when I have to go to the army, reserve duty, so as soon as I start putting on my khaki, you know, the camouflage stuff, and I start putting on my boots, I feel myself growing. Plus, like I'm turning into Rabbi Rambo, right? So I'm like, and when I go to the office and I go to the place where they give out supplies, and I get my gun, I'm like, I'm transformed. It's like, which direction is Syria, buddy? Just point me there, you know? The clothing you wear affects you. It also affects how others look at you. You know, a friend of mine who is an actor, very minor actor. He has another friend who's even more minor actor. He's type of the guy, you may have seen him, he was floating next to some debris near the Titanic. Yeah. Right, that's the type of role he usually gets. Like lying on a street in the Western, floating in the water, that type of thing. He's very good at it, but yeah. Anyway, so now, he's Irish Catholic, and he was hired to be an extra in a film which was based on a Chaim Potok novel. He was hired to be a Hasidic extra in a wedding, because no self-respecting Hasid would ever act in a Chaim Potok movie. So therefore, you have to hire an Irish Catholic to dress as a Hasid to act in a movie done by Chaim Potok. Okay. So he's dressed in he's got the black hat, he's got the black coat, he's got the beard, he's got the whole works. Okay? And, you know, they're filming in Brooklyn, and he's getting very bored with the catering service in the movie unit. So he decides during a break in filming, goes to one of his favorite Italian delis. So the chassid, he walks into the deli. Italian behind the counter with a large crucifix. And this chassidish guy says, look, give me a ham and Swiss on rye, will you? And the Italian says, no. And he says, what do you mean no? It's a free country, give me the ham and Swiss on rye. The Italian says, you want to go to hell, you do it yourself, buddy, I'm not going to help you. Finally, he realizes how he's dressed, and he says, you don't understand, he says, I'm Catholic like you. He says, I'm an actor in a movie. Just go around the corner, you see the Klieg lights and everything. I'm an actor, really, seriously. The Italian says, I've heard that before, get out of my store. So it affects how others look at you. You know, actually, I know someone who used to travel a lot, doing customs supervision. He was in O'Hare Airport, and he missed the morning minion, so he's putting on tefillin in O'Hare. So he pulls up his sleeve, he puts the tefillin on his visor, he's pulling it tight. As he described it, a large fellow in a pink velour jumpsuit, extensive body piercing, mohawk, a shaved skull, and Ray-Bans comes over to him, puts his hand on his, and he says, "Man, you ain't going to shoot up here in front of everyone, are you?" So, tefillin can save you from drug abuse as well. Right, but the point is that minor things like clothing have an impact on how you think of yourself, have an impact on how others think of you, and it's our actions that actually affect the inner self, as the Sefer HaChinuch says, Ha'adam Nif'al Kafi Pu'uloisav, the person is affected by their actions. E. Obligation and morality without enforcement. Judaism has been a system, as Susan Last Stone points out, oh, I see it got cut off in the facts. Oh no, it's on the back as well, okay. So, that Judaism has been a system which has survived intact without major law enforcement, without a police system, without a court system. It has survived based on the Jews understanding a sense of obligation. The word, the mitzvahs for us speak to us. All the law enforcement in the world will not help if people don't have morality and self-control within them. There's a beautiful story. Reb Levi Yitzhak of Berditchev, a Hasidic rebbe, lived in Berditchev, which was in Russia. Now, at the time, Russia and Turkey had hostilities, and it was illegal to possess anything from Turkey. So this is just before Pesach, just before the Seder night, and Reb Levi Yitzhak of Berditchev says, okay, now, by the way, I should point out, I'm not encouraging smuggling here, but the Tsar was a filthy anti-Semite, and Jews had no respect for him. So anyway, just background. So anyway, Reb Levi Yitzhak of Berditchev says, I want some Turkish silk before we start Seder. People are saying, Turkish silk? What does he want Turkish silk for heaven's sakes, A? And B, it's illegal. If we get caught with this, we're dead. Levi Yitzhak says, I want silk. So the Rebbe said it. Okay. 5 minutes later, they got silk. Then he says, we're not starting until I get Turkish tobacco. Yeah. So they say, tobacco, Turkish tobacco. He says, I want Turkish tobacco. 5 minutes later, Turkish tobacco. Then he says, right, now, last thing I want some bread. They say, Rebbe, Berditchev is a Jewish town. There is not a crumb of bread here on Pesach. He says, I want bread. So they go out, they search the whole place, which they did the previous night as well. Right, and everyone comes back, they come back frustrated, dirty, exhausted, confused. They say, Rebbe, there is not a drop, a crumb of bread in this city. So Levi Yitzhak says, aha. He takes the silk and tobacco and he says, God, look at this. The Tsar has got secret police, has got border guards, he's got not secret police, he's got a court system that hates the Jews, he's got a population that hates the Jews, and it takes me 10 minutes to get silk and tobacco from Turkey. All you said is, don't have chametz, 3,500 years ago, and there is not a crumb of bread in Berditchev. The amazing power of the commandments, where the Jews still keep them without that enforcement, obligation, is what creates morality, not law enforcement. And finally, 1F, rights versus obligations. There's a beautiful story in the Medrash Rabbah, Parshas Noach, I've quoted here in number 2. Alexander of Macedon, the great conqueror of much of the world, who wept at the age of 30 that there were no worlds left to conquer. And Alexander of Macedon was visiting North Africa. He was on vacation, he didn't conquer it till the next summer. So he's meeting with this African king, and a court case comes before the king. And the court case is the following. One guy says, I just bought a field from this guy. And as I'm plowing the field, my plow hits something. I dig it up, and there is a box of money. So obviously, this fellow must have left it in the field. Here, it's his. The guy who sold in the field says, oh no. He says, I signed a contract in which I transferred the field and everything in it to you. True. I forgot the money was there, but it's yours. You believe this? Right? One guy saying it's yours, the other guy saying it's yours. I know what we'd do. I would sue him for damaging my plow, and I would hide the fact there was money in there so the IRS can't get me. Right? But this guy saying, no, you take the money. The other guy saying, you take the money. Alexander is in a state of shock. So the African king says, he says to one guy, he says, you got a son? He says, yeah. How old is he? He says, 19. Says to the other guy, you got a daughter? He says, how old is she? He says, 18. So the king says, right, by virtue of the power invested in me, well, by me, he says, I hereby declare them married, and the money that you found in the field will go to their betrothal. And they mazel tov, they're all happy, and they leave. At least, I don't know about the kids, who cares? Parents are happy, that's the main thing. Right? So now, they both walk out happy. Alexander of Macedon is in a state of shock. Cannot believe what's going on here. I mean, one guy's saying, you take the money, the other guy's saying, you take the money, and they're unbelievable. So the African king asks Alexander, he says, well, why do you look so flabbergasted? He says, look, in my country this has never happened. The guy would find the money, he'd take it and run. And the king asks Alexander, and he says, if it did happen in your country, how would you have decided the case? Alexander says, obvious, I would have killed them both and taken the money from my treasury. Now the African king says to Alexander, says, does the sun rise every day where you live? Alexander says, yeah. Does the rain come down? Yeah. The African says, are there animals where you live? Alexander says, yes. And then the king says, it must be, therefore, that the rain comes down and the sun rises in the merits of the animals. Because the humans where you live clearly don't deserve it. Very beautiful medrash. But it's telling us an important message. In this African country is a metaphor for Judaism, the Jewish system. And Alexander is the Greek and the Western system. In the Western system, the focus is on rights. It's, I found something in my field, it's my right to keep it. And if it damaged my plow, it's my right to sue you for everything you've got because of the damage. And the other guy's thinking, I left something in the field, it's my right to get it back. And Alexander is thinking, I'm the king, it's my right to do anything the heck I want. Rights tend to be inwardly focused. What can I get? What can I receive? What do I deserve? In this African system and in Judaism, what is the focus? Obligation. I found something in my field. It's my obligation to return it to the correct owner. The other guy is thinking, I signed a contract. It's my obligation to fulfill the words of the contract. And the king is thinking, it's my obligation to make my subjects happy. In obligation, it's not what I can get, it's what I can give. In fact, we often confuse this. People speak about love. Love in Judaism is obligation. It means my obligation to give to the other person. Ahava love, the two middle letters, spell hav, which means to give. Very often, as Reb Dessler says, when a person says, I love someone, they mean not that I want to give, but I want to take. He says, for example, when a person says, I love fish, what do they usually do after that? Kill it, gut it, skin it, fry it, eat it. Is that a fish lover? If you love the fish, throw it back in the ocean. Don't kill it and eat it. What do you mean when you say I love fish? Rodessa says the following. I love myself. And the sensation I get from eating charred fish carcass is indeed pleasurable. That's what I like. Unfortunately, when we say I love him or her, we mean very similar. I love myself. The physical, social, emotional, and economic benefits I get from my relationship with him, her, is pleasing to me. I love that. That's me. That's confusing taking with giving. Okay, love means here's a person I want to give everything I can to. The Kabbalists actually discuss why do we kiss as an expression of love. My kids often ask me this. No, kiss anyway. Right? So why do we kiss as an expression of love? Biologically, it makes no sense. Makes no sense to kiss. I mean, it's a stupid thing, right? Kissing. So the Kabbalists say the answer is this. It is the desire to give the very breath of your life to the person whom you love. And their desire to give the very breath of their life to the person they love. It's the desire to give which is expressed in that way. So the idea here is obligation is giving. Rights is based on taking. The Jewish system and all the commandments places a heavy emphasis on the feeling of obligation so that we are not inwardly selfishly focused, but we are outwardly generously focused. And I'd like to end, to paraphrase, John F. Kennedy's speech at his inauguration. Paraphrase, the end of his speech. This is what Judaism is saying with the abundance of mitzvot. Ask not what others can do for you, ask what you can do for others. That's really one of the essences of the commandments. Just to summarize, Purpose of the commandments, refinement, consciousness, being good, and revealing godliness in the world. Methodology of the commandments, commitment and consistency. A living law which applies to every time, every place, and every situation. Making us aware of the spiritual, of the philosophical, of the meaningful side of life. Rituals to modify our behavior. Commandments to teach us obligation and self-control so we don't need law enforcement. And finally, the commandments to teach us obligation instead of only rights, giving instead of only taking, and that's really the essence of the commandments. That's it for today. Thank you very much.